now that heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to that one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight, we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick old trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble and drunk. Trouble on the drum, beat out old trouble on the drum, and kick old trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum, beat me that rhythm on the drum, beat me that rhythm on the drum, and kick old trouble out the door. Kick him out the door, kick him out the door, kick him out the door, kick him out the door.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. Henrietta, how are you? Henrietta does not want to speak. She's our new producer. She's wonderful and wears a cap inside a studio, which I find unusual, but that's maybe she's American. We'll ask her one day when she speaks. We do have a great, well, I don't know if she's a great guest, but she's been here before. Jeannie number two, Jeannie Marsh.
Hi.
Now, didn't I see you before Christmas?
Yeah, we were in here with a mob of about 15 singers and instrumentalists.
Yeah, I remember that.
Playing live with Climate Choir Melbourne. Singing our special radical Christmas carols amongst
other. Radical Christmas carols. Did you get any complaints?
No, we got one acclamation. From
one acclamation.
One was better than none.
Right. One acclamation. Yeah. I love that.
No, it was great. And it was great to have those recordings too, so that we can, because it's great to actually be in a studio, because we're usually on the streets. That's what Climate Choir does.
Oh, right. Right. And what do you do with Climate Choir? I've forgotten.
Oh, I just wave my hands around.
Yeah, yeah. But now you disciplined me there, I remember. You see, you're not the mistress, you're not the master. What are you of the choir?
Musical director.
Musical director.
I have to take responsibility if things fall apart musically or if they are brilliant musically, and also to make sure that in a community choir that everybody's having a really good time and feeling very confident in what they're doing musically, whether or not they've ever sung or ever read music before.
Excuse me? Yeah. Do you have people in the choir that have never sung?
You bet.
I can't believe it.
No, it's lots.
Really?
Australia is not a singing culture.
No, it's not.
No. And often people, or the other thing that we get is people hit their 50s, 60s, 70s and start singing in a community choir, having never sung since primary school. When somebody told them, you're out of tune,
that's right,
go home.
Tone deaf.
Which is absolutely brutal and also completely untrue, because everybody can sing.
Well, I was convinced I'm tone deaf, so maybe one day I'll join the choir.
Yeah.
And pigs may fly. Now, Jeannie, we're basically here not to talk about the choir. We're here to talk about you.
Mm-hmm.
Can we ask what year you were born?
1959. I'm a boomer, and that's how it is.
Well, you're a late boomer.
Very late boomer, but not a late bloomer.
No. 1959. Where were you born?
I was born here in Melbourne, and I've basically lived most of my life in Melbourne.
You weren't born at the Jesse McPherson.
No, I was born in the Bethlehem Hospital in Caulfield.
We've had guests here who have been born there.
You're born in Bethlehem.
Yeah, I've had a few guests that were born in Bethlehem at Caulfield. I assume it doesn't exist anymore.
It exists, but now it's an aged care specialty hospital, so I don't know what that means.
It fits in nicely, yes, doesn't it?
Right.
Aged care specialty hospital.
Yeah.
I like it. It's a great transformation. Yeah. Now, what's your earliest childhood memory?
Well, I grew up in Beaumaris, so by the sea, and probably the earliest memories are of the beach.
Right.
So I was just a total water baby.
Tell us about them, those memories, tell us.
Yeah, so going down probably as a toddler or 3 years old, whatever, and my mother and sister and granny, father, all there while I just ran straight into the water.
Right.
As a tiny, tiny little thing.
So we...
And, you know, just... That's never changed. I've always just been a water baby.
Well, so you remember Ricketts Point?
Ricketts Point, you bet. I spent a lot of time there.
What, looking at the sea life in the rock pools?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Avoiding the blue-ringed octopus because they...
They do exist. And
they
people,
were very poisonous.
Yeah, and occasionally a kid used to die on the beach.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And also when I got older, so that it was a really big thing as a preteen and a teen. To be given free rein by my parents, bless them, to just go down and hang around on the beach during the summer, take a book, take a sandwich, spend hours, and just that thing of doing it on your own and them trusting me, I think it's really valuable.
Did you join some of those wild parties at Black Rock Beach?
No, I had never, a sort of sheltered kind of...
Didn't you?
Yeah, didn't. Yeah, And I had two sisters and then... So I went to Balmoris Primary, which was mixed school, but then went to all-girls school.
How old were you when you went to the all-girls school?
Oh, about 11.
11, so what, grade 4 or 5 you transferred?
Oh, no.
Secondary college.
Yeah.
God, you must have been a genius going... Grade, what, six
no,
or
no,
seven?
No. Grade 7, I just went to secondary school like everybody else.
Yeah.
So absolutely normal, totally nothing to see there.
You know the tragedy of Beaumaris, Morty Alec, Aspendale, all those beach suburbs, is that you can never return because the property prices. Oh,
I know.
Because they weren't gentrified suburbs, they were just family suburbs.
No, well, my parents... bought a very, very modest weatherboard house there in that modernist style because that was the style. And it was all amongst the tea tree. There were no made roads. I mean, it really was a bit of a bohemian, bushy, beachy place. People had ponies.
Yep.
I mean, it was pretty idyllic.
It was.
There were a lot of... arty people, potters, writers, musicians, activists. So that's what it was like there. I mean, I was too young to know that at that time.
Yeah.
But now it's been definitely knocked down those 60s and 70s houses and built mansions.
Been transformed. I was there a few days. I was down at Ricketts. I usually go down to Ricketts Point on a Tuesday, which was yesterday, and I was there yesterday, and obviously it was very hot. And there's the cafe there. And,
yeah, it's beautiful.
And the little park and the Banksias.
Yeah, and that hasn't changed.
No.
That's just as it always was, except there used to be this ancient Edwardian milk bar there run by two grumpy old women.
Oh, not grumpy old men like me. No, grumpy old women. Yeah.
And so it was a real part of the experience to go and buy your ice cream from them. But you know, it's somewhere that I think the people who live there now, even though it's obviously been gentrified and so on, there's still people who are obsessed with the beach.
Oh, there are.
It's quite a bit further out. It's not Brighton,
no.
Where you can quickly get to the city.
Yes.
It's, you know, you've got to be seriously committed to being by the beach.
Yeah, and there's not much public transport down at Morris.
No.
And the great thing is, as you know, is it's the only urban marine park now in Australia. I mean, the whole place is made marine park, and you'd be surprised at the bird life that was there yesterday at Ricketts Point. It was just extraordinary, the number of birds.
Yeah.
Obviously, they were trying to cool off in the heat.
Mm.
Now, your parents,
yes.
Were they born here?
No. Now we get to the political part of my life, I suppose, because my parents were... colonial English people direct from the British Raj in India.
How long were they there for?
Oh, basically their entire lives. So, and this is generations of their families.
Right.
Back and forth to England. So every 3 to 5 years they'd go back to England and stay with relatives and buy things like 78 records to take back to India. My father was in the oil business and, you know, they lived just the classic British colonial life at that time in the Raj, which was the swimming club, the water polo club, having servants, Yeah, it was a different world, and it was their world. And of course, when they left, well, after partition, after independence, most of the English left. So most of them went back to England.
Mm-hmm.
But my father, he was a bit of an adventurer. He was just in his early 40s, and he said, "No, let's go somewhere completely different." So.
Right.
He said, "Let's go to Australia, and also there'll be better weather there."
Hmm.
And so my mother, went along with that plan. But it wasn't really until I was born. My sisters were born in India, but I was born here, and then she started really connecting to Australia and saying, "Oh yeah, there's some fantastic things here.
Right.
It's a great place to bring up a family."
Well, they wouldn't have had servants.
They didn't have servants. She didn't know how to boil an egg.
Right.
No, nothing.
No, nothing.
The local butcher in Beaumaris, she went in and said, "Can you teach me how to feed my family?"
Right.
Incredible. And he did.
He did.
You know, you don't eating two veg.
You don't remember his name, do you?
It'll come to me.
It'll come to me. It'll tell us.
Yeah.
And what are your parents' names? Let's just remember them.
Bobby and Fred.
Right. Did they have the occasional gin and tonic?
My father was a whiskey man.
A whiskey man.
Yeah, so every day that's when he came home from work, had a chota peg.
A what?
Chota peg, so that was the
Can you explain? Please explain.
Yeah, so chota meant, their version of Hindustani, who knows if it was true. Kitchen Hindustani, they called it. So chota means small and peg means a drink.
Right.
So a chota peg means
a
small drink. And that could be a gin and tonic or
whatever.
Whatever it was.
Did he continue in the oil industry when he came to Australia?
He worked at BP.
Right.
Yeah,
and
how did
your mother, how did she fill in her time apart from looking after you three brats?
Yeah, well, that was it. So she was totally a very, very loving home carer, and that's what she wanted to do in her life. That was her mission, and she did it very well.
Mm.
And
that's right. Yeah. We tend to denigrate people who've done that, but obviously it is an exceptionally important job.
She totally wanted to do it, and she brought up three very, very strong, independent women.
Yeah, and that's the tragedy, isn't it? In 2026, if you're in a relationship, you're a couple, both of you've got to go to work to keep a roof over your heads,
or a couple of jobs. That's right.
It wasn't like then where one person could go to work and the other person could do the home duties.
Yeah, and then when her mother migrated as well.
Your grandmother.
The Scottish grandmother.
What was she like?
She was a strong woman.
Well, is she directly from Scotland or from India?
No, they're all India. It's India all the way.
Right.
Yeah, so from both sides of the family.
Right.
She was a strong woman, and she's had retained her Scottish accent and her Scottish traditions. So that's where we all embraced the whole New Year's Eve, Hogmanay, all the Scottish songs, the Scottish sayings, all came from my grandmother. But I could never come at things that she loved, such as tripe.
Tripe. Nothing.
Forget it.
Nothing wrong with tripe cooked in milk.
Please.
Sliced in front of you.
No.
It's disgusting, isn't it?
I'm happy for you to cook it up, but then just take it to the bin.
Well, people don't understand. People needed to eat that stuff because
the
meat was so expensive. Heart, lung, tripe.
And dripping.
Know.
Having things with dripping. I mean, that was how she was brought up in Glasgow when she was a child.
Well, I was born 8 years before you. I'm a real baby boomer. Yep. And I remember going to school with dripping on a piece of bread with salt and pepper, and that was your lunch. Nothing wrong with it.
No.
As long as you put salt and pepper on it.
That's right.
Without salt and pepper, it's disgusting.
Yeah, that's it. So, so look, that whole period of people from the Raj coming here, and there weren't that many.
No.
So most of them did go back to England, or they went to
South Africa
where they could continue to have servants.
The same lifestyle.
And weather.
Yeah.
But so I think, you know, the opportunity to have a new life, I really respect them for saying, let's do it. We don't know anybody here.
As you said,
no job.
They were in the late 30s, early 40s.
Yeah.
Huge thing. So did your grandmother live here or did you visit?
Yeah, no, she lived here initially just with us, and there was a very, very small house, and there were two women trying to run the house.
Right.
Eventually, you know, it was half and half. She lived with her son, my uncle, in Adelaide for half the year, and that worked well.
That worked well, yeah. And are your parents still alive?
No, no, they died some years ago. Yeah,
right.
Decades ago.
Just, you reminded me of something when you said your parents had died. Did you know, this is a useless fact you can remember, that cremation was illegal in Victoria in the 19th century?
Yeah, I can imagine that.
And they used to have secret cremations in the late 1890s as a protest on Blackrock Beach.
Wow.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Well, I've learned something there about my local stamping ground, for sure.
Yeah, I lived down there for a number of years, and that was one of the interesting facts because, you know, they still got the Beaumaris Historical. Well, it's actually not the Beaumaris. I think it's the Sandringham Historical Society, which covers Beaumaris.
Yeah.
So you went to high school, a girls' private school.
there was Furbank in Brighton.
Oh, very nice.
And, it was what my parents thought. They didn't know anything. They'd only been here a few years when my elder sister's going to high school. Mm. And they looked around, tried to understand what is the education system here. And it seemed to them that Furbank would provide the best education available compared to Sandringham.
Yep.
High school at that time was a great place. And I suppose, you know, I can look at all these things in retrospect now because since I grew up and left home, you know, I became incredibly aware of the privilege of my upbringing and what I had at that school. I mean, I got into music because they had a fantastic music department.
Yep.
Otherwise, there's no way I would have got into music.
That's right.
And was able to get the sort of education that could enable me to get into university. So
you spent all the time high school at Furbank.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
No, I'm a bit confused here.
Yeah.
Did you used to wear a boater?
No.
You didn't wear
No, I came in after the hats.
After the hats, right.
Yeah, yeah.
My I've got this distinct memory of wearing a boater.
My elder sister had the hat and the gloves.
The hat and the gloves, yeah. Yeah.
But then, you know, then I've spent, you know, ever since I sort of became, I don't know.
Now, look, you don't have to justify. I'm just interested.
No, but, you know, you say it with a little touch of the elitist thing and... most people I work with in activism do think, oh, you went to a private school. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, I think it's unfair because we are what our parents decided to do. They were doing the best they could.
It's not an issue. We've got many people who have been educated at private schools, some much better than Furbank, MLC, you know.
Surely.
So, no. Look. Everybody's got a path in life and sometimes it's got nothing to do with us, and that's what happens when you're a child.
That's it. You're at the mercy of whatever the random events that led your parents to where they were.
You could be brought up as a neo-Nazi.
Exactly.
You know, and people don't seem to understand that. You can't blame a child for the way they were brought up.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's the way it is. So I'm not making any aspersions about anything. I'm just interested that you actually went to the girls' school and you did music. Is there anything else you liked at school or excelled at high school?
I became very obsessed with performing very early on. So I was
obsessed?
Obsessed.
Why?
I just, as soon as I discovered the thing of being in front of people, I was just, it became clear that I was a performing extrovert type.
Right.
And I hadn't quite found what it was I wanted to perform at, but the minute I got involved in the school choir when I was in year 10, that was it. Mm. It was just incredibly clear.
The choir? Singing. Or did you do stage performances?
Do some stage things, but always connected with music.
With music.
But I loved the drama classes. I loved anything. Mm. You know, I loved bossing people around. That was very clear.
Right. So, No. You weren't bossing people around. You were directing them.
I was directing them. I had ideas for little events that would happen in the school with music or theatre, and I just, you know, wrangle people to get them happening.
Mm. So you would have made prefect, I assume, in year 12?
Yeah, music prefect, which music was prefect. Outrageous because I could barely read music having
excuse me.
Yep.
6 years?
Yeah, I know.
Fairbank? In the choir?
Yep.
And you could barely read music.
Yes,
what's going on
facts.
Here? What's going on here?
Well, I think it's something to do with singers tend to discover whether they've got a voice, an instrument, later. So maybe, you know, with boys, often only after their voice is broken, and with girls, often after puberty. And you think, oh, yeah, I've got an instrument. And so then you start having singing lessons, start thinking. So I only started having singing lessons in year 12.
Right, right.
And whereas people have started on piano or violin, you know, some of them start learning at 4. So they've had years and years of learning how to read music if they've gone down the classical path. Whereas for singers, often they only realise that, oh, yeah, shit, I better start learning how to read music, learn a bit about theory, learn other languages if you're a singer. Mm. It all just becomes clear much, much later.
Mm. So you said you had a, you know, you found, discovered your voice in high school.
Mm.
Did it lead in any particular direction? Did you become an opera singer or...? Mm.
Yes, well, that was part of the environment I was in, so at the private girls' school at that time. So that was the only path. So it was classical singing.
Classical, right.
Opera, classical music. Mm. And so that's the path I went. And so then I went to the conservatorium. So at that, and you know, the schools are much different now and music courses are much different.
Right.
But at that time... There wasn't a swing band, there wasn't musicals happening, there wasn't all sorts of things. There wasn't, forget, world music, independent singer-songwriter, you know, all of that. Just, it was just, it's not what they were offering in those schools.
So
I didn't know, but I would never have had the voice to be a rock and roll singer. I don't have the right sort of vocal cords.
We've interviewed rock and roll stars and I prefer to talk to an opera singer any day. They're up themselves, I'm sorry.
Wow.
Every rock and roll star I've chatted here is...
Yeah. Have you met any opera divas? They can be wild.
No, I haven't. I haven't.
Yeah,
no,
they
no,
can
I'm,
be absolutely up themselves.
Yeah, well, I'm going overseas in a few days and I'm going to the London Opera. Maybe I'll meet a diva. We'll see.
Yeah.
Now, so you graduated. What year?
From the university? Or
No, from high school. We're not at high school.
From high school, yeah. So I was still high school, the end of 76.
End of 76. And was the world your oyster?
Yeah, pretty much. I was just desperate to get out there and study and learn everything I could and just get on a stage.
Really?
Oh, God.
You didn't want to be a doctor or a vet?
Nope.
What was wrong with you that you wanted to go on the stage? What's going on here?
Yeah, no, totally obsessed with performing.
And were your parents devastated?
No, they were really supportive and really they hadn't had, because they were both people who'd had very, very little education.
Right.
And had to leave school very early and didn't have any opportunities to do music or the arts at all, but loved it. So they were, you know, and those people in the early years in Melbourne who would be going along to the opera and the ballet and whatever concert was on just to immerse themselves. They loved it.
Right.
So when I went into it, they were very happy and very supportive and didn't say, oh, well, why don't you become a doctor or a lawyer? But they did. My father was concerned that I do have a path in the once I went to the conservatorium where I could earn a living should my dream of performing fall over.
Lover, right.
So he did insisted quite strongly that I do the music education course so that I could teach music. And as it turned out, my God, he was right.
Right, they usually are
used
parents.
I used that degree so much. The jobs that I had sitting side by side as day jobs with my performing, we're always using that teaching degree.
One thing I learned is it's only after about 30 years that you realise that when you're 50 or 60, you realise your parents were much wiser than you thought they were when you thought you knew everything as a teenager.
That's it.
What was it like the first day you walked in the conservatorium in 1977? It would have been a bit different to Furbank.
There was a bit of imposter syndrome going on there because I did realise very quickly that I was, you know, like a baby amidst these people who had had so much more experience than me. But I loved being in the university environment. I just lapped it up. And, you know, it was mixed. There were boys and girls. And I hadn't had that at all at the girls' school.
They didn't lead
you
astray, did it?
Oh, well, yeah, I suppose it did.
It did.
Because probably the first group I joined at the university was the university choir.
Right.
And that was dominated by Randy Young engineering and science and medicine students who were, it was a fantastic marriage academy, that choir. And I think, you know, university choirs still are a fantastic place because you meet people from all the faculties. You know, literally, it was just every faculty was there. So you got to socialise, a lot of socialising. That was the first socialising. You know, I had to go across the road to Norton's to learn how to drink, to learn what to drink. I had no idea.
Yeah, no idea.
No idea. No. I'd had a sherry, you know, with my family.
Shandy. Yeah, yeah.
Let's get that clear.
Beer and lemonade. Yeah. Yes.
But, you know, so that was really part of, you know, university was a very big learning experience.
Especially in the late 70s.
Well, I had free education. Mm. I didn't have to have a job.
No.
Throughout 5 years at university.
And the beauty was, I mean, my great belief is, I mean, I'm a product of that period. I graduated from medical school, I think it's 76. The thing was, the difference is you had that freedom.
Mm.
Where you had an end-of-year exam.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to do continuous assessment.
No.
And once continuous assessment was introduced into universities as well as fee paying, it destroyed that ability for you to do what you want and maybe just cram at the end of the year, pass and go on to the next year.
Yeah, and if you wanted, if you're a very, very highly motivated person who did want to get the top marks, well, you could do that.
Well, you went for a distinction,
Or you could, so I reckon the first semester that I had in 1977, I was just, I don't know what I was doing. I didn't know anything, and I was just getting used to the whole thing and going into the city every day from Beaumaris, you know, a long way, and meeting all these people and, you know, so, and I was able to have that a semester of, you know, learning to be independent as a young adult.
Look, it's a very common experience from people who come from single-sex schools, from that environment straight to a university without taking a gap year. And nobody took a gap year in those days.
No,
didn't exist. Never heard of it. You just went. You went from high school to university to a job.
Mm.
So when did you graduate from university?
Well, it was stretched out a little bit.
Stretched out, free education.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, stretched it
hopeless.
Out. Yeah.
Because, as I've told you, so I was obsessed with performing. And so in my third year, I realised that I wanted to do more studying for performing. So I joined the opera studio at the National Theatre that then was incorporated into the extremely new Victorian College of the Arts.
Right.
So I was finishing my music education degree then part-time while 3 nights a week for 3 years I was going to St Kilda and the VCA and just doing totally performance-based things. So learning how to move on stage, learning how to do a sword fight, learning all these scenes from different operas, putting on operas. And then I was so excited by that that then I extended that and did a postgraduate diploma in the same opera and music theatre area.
Look, we should have a camera in here, Henrietta.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could see the joy in your face.
Oh yeah, I was
total
pretty,
joy.
I found my people.
You were sparkling.
Yeah.
It was amazing just looking at your face when you said that.
Wow.
How hard is it? Opera training. How hard is it?
Well, it is extremely strenuous thing. It's like an athletic thing, really.
Athlete for the vocal cords, is it?
Yeah, but also it's your whole body and your mental and emotional. So you've got to be an athlete in that, you know, it's a long form. So operas are often 2 hours long.
Right.
And if you've got a main role, you might be singing for, you know, at least an hour of that, and also running around the stage, literally running around the stage, and having to produce a sound that can carry to the back of a huge theatre like the State Theatre over an orchestra.
Right.
So you're training your body to, you have to be very strong and flexible and up for anything. The director might get you hanging upside down on a trapeze singing your aria. And you say, okay, sure,
I'll do that.
But also be right in time. So there's the musicianship side of things, which is you've got to be really, really incredibly detailed in that and go into the first rehearsal with the professional, if you're in a professional organisation, with the role totally prepared. So you've put in months of work preparing, often in another language. So you at the conservatorium, so there weren't many singing students at that time. There were just, I think, six across the whole course. But now there's many more since they started wanting to get money in.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They started letting in a lot
anybody,
of singers.
Anybody.
Well, a lot of singers, whereas it had always been instrumental-based before then. So we, this little group of singing students, so we were learning Italian, French and German to a level where you could prepare and sing and translate and communicate those complex roles in these three languages at least. But then I got very interested early on in other languages, particularly Spanish. So I was very interested in Spanish and Latin American music as soon as I discovered it. And then, of course, there was Latin because a lot of classical singing, you're singing in a mass. So that's all in Latin. And then other things come along, like if you want to sing Stravinsky, that's all in Russian.
Right.
And I was very interested in those.
Did you pursue let's use the word professional, you got paid, career in opera?
Yeah, totally.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, while I was at the opera studio, so about 21, and I just finished my teaching degree, so I was teaching in a high school, teaching school music during the day, and then in the evening going to the opera school, and then during the day I got a job in the chorus of the Victorian State Opera, as it was at that time, now Victorian Opera.
Right.
And that was just a huge learning experience. So being in the opera chorus is just, it's really trial by fire. You just got to rock up, and you're working as a complete beginner, surrounded by often very, very experienced people and sometimes international stars, and your job is to learn a lot of music and then do a lot of movement on stage and singing and staying in time with the conductor. So looking at the conductor, but it must never look as though you're looking at the conductor. So there's a lot of skills to do with opera that I learnt in the opera chorus. And then a big one of which was punctuality. You got to turn up
right.
on time, and if you're not,
they close the door. Oh, it's like going to the opera. They'll close the door on you if you don't turn up on time.
Well, that's right. But it'll also happen in an opera rehearsal, particularly with a young artist, to teach you a lesson. You know, there's very few jobs available in this. If you don't turn up, forget it.
Forget it.
Yeah. So, learning to be well prepared, all those things were very important. And then I got an opportunity to be young artist, which is sort of their young training program where they paid you to do small roles and do understudy roles. So that's where I got to learn huge roles like Carmen, to understudy them, but then and be doing small roles on the main stage.
Yeah.
And then we had country tours in those days where they shoved the whole of the opera chorus, who all had day jobs, put them in a bus and took them off to Warrnambool or Ballarat or Bendigo.
Well, that's fascinating, because I remember when I was a high school student, I was in high school in Brisbane, and it was a public school, and we would get opera singers touring and coming to this, you know, this backward school where we didn't even know what opera meant.
Yeah.
You know, and people would, it was a cultural immersion.
Well, it was, and because you were there, when we went on those country tours, sometimes we were performing in the netball stadium with the full orchestra and the choir and everything. And, you know, extraordinary experience for everybody. And it was really an event for the town and we were billeted. You know, and stayed with the local, whoever, the electrician or the squatter. and they were responsible for getting there in time and had these amazing suppers after every show. And it was always the orchestra got in first to the suppers because they didn't have to get out of their costume and get rid of the makeup and everything. So most of the food sometimes was gone by the time the chorus got there, which was deeply unfair.
did this lead to any work overseas in the field?
Yeah. So I did start applying for grants sort of the path often for Australian singers still now is to go and have extra study overseas with experts. So I applied for those grants and got some of those grants and studied in Italy and in London. And while I was there, I was applying for work and also getting involved in, so a bit later in the 90s, going to summer school in England, which was a whole month. You stayed there and got involved in everything. And through that got work with Covent Garden Opera Company with their new opera organisation, because during the course of these years of being a professional classical singer, I got more and more interested in working on new music, working with composers and writers. Right. And the idea that when you open your mouth, people have no idea what's going to come out. Whereas if you go to see Traviata or Magic Flute or Carmen, a lot of the audience and everybody on stage has been doing those pieces for 100 years.
Yeah. What do you call those people that take out a yearly subscription? Yeah, because they
love it. They love it. It. Bless them.
Without them you wouldn't exist. No. Because
but they want to hear the traditional repertoire. So and you do need to keep performing the traditional repertoire because they're masterpieces and each generation deserves the right to hear them and to sing them. But, you know, what about the Australian composers? How are we going to ever give them the opportunity to write an opera and become good at writing operas? So I got really obsessed again with working in new opera, and that's what I did in London. And I started doing more and more in Melbourne. I just put my hand up and applied and started performing and became that was my reputation, was that I preferred to do new work.
Right.
So it was better to work with somebody who wanted to do it rather than somebody who was there grudgingly saying, I wish I was doing La Boheme instead.
Instead, yeah. Do you think there's many opportunities for public opportunities in terms of public support for young opera singers today compared to your time?
No, there never has been. It's a very, very difficult route. And in Australia particularly, you know, when I was starting out, when I was a young artist, there were opportunities you could apply for and young artist programs. Even the National Opera Company in Sydney did tour in Melbourne quite a lot in the other cities and employ singers in each city. But all of that, you know, there's just been drastic cuts to the arts funding and it was always small, you know, compared to Germany where many, many small towns have an opera company and an orchestra paid for by taxpayers.
Yeah.
Mm. And people are proud of it like they're proud of their local footy team.
Yeah.
So it's always been a battle. So that's one of my big hobby horses is the lack of respect and funding for the arts in Australia. And, you know, I think it's just an uphill battle, always has been.
Yeah. I remember in the early 70s, during the Whitlam era, there was a little bit of
Oh, movement, there was a flurry then, yeah.
Flurry, and then it just died.
Yeah, well, that's when the arts, you know, really got it. Yeah. That's where the film industry took off. Yeah. But also then with Keating, though Keating totally got the arts.
Yeah.
He started thinking broadly about how can we build generations of Australian artists who they can be involved in international work, but that they want to be based here and build their career here. So he did a lot of work to really make the arts more respected in Australia. But then when he left, it was back to nothing. Yeah.
It's how old were you? And I shouldn't ask this, but I'm going to. How old were you when you decided that you needed to take up your father's advice regarding having a real job?
A real job? Oh, well, part of the course that I did, the Bachelor of Music Education, was supported by having a studentship. So remember those things?
Yes, I remember studentships.
So studentships were this enlightened system where if young people leaving school decided they wanted to teach and did a teaching degree, they would be paid to do that study. Yeah, not just that it was free.
No, you were paid. That's right.
And it was that the money I was paid for those 4 years I did my course, the teaching course, was enough to cover rent on a student house. So it was, you know, a significant amount of money and to drive a beaten-up VW Beetle. Mm. So I was lucky to be on a studentship, but that meant that you were obliged to teach wherever they sent you.
That's right.
For a year.
Udnadatta, here we come.
Yep, that's right.
Where did you end up?
Well, I was lucky in that, because I was still doing this course, the evening course, so I asked to be given a Melbourne school and I was given Canterbury Girls High School, which in many ways would have been a dream run if I had any interest at all in teaching classroom music, which I discovered immediately I didn't have. So
there wouldn't have been as many high school students like you who were in love with drama and music. You were just, you'd be teaching. Most of the girls would, or boys, they would.
They didn't want to be there. There was that. Mm. But also, I mean, what I enjoyed was doing the school musical, leading the students in that. Basically I realised I didn't have that. That was not my driving ambition to be a school music teacher. But so I did do that. So that was 1981. I did that. So that's when I took up my father's
advice.
And I did give it I gave it a good go. But then by the end of that year, it was when I thought that I was going to actually pick up a girl and throw her out the window.
You could get away with it then, but not today.
So I applied to, and I got married early. So right. And if you got married, you only had to do 1 year of your studentship. And if you had a baby, you did none of them. But right. I'd never had a baby. But right. I did get married, and that meant I could just do 1 year of my studentship. Mm. And then I went just hell for leather for the performing. Mm. But the teaching experience and the qualification, everything about teaching, I realised later on, I just loved working in certain environments. I loved working with older students. So I taught about 15 years ago, I was teaching at Distance Education Centre, teaching VCE students.
Please explain. No, you didn't jump. But just excuse me, Distance Education Centre.
Crazy,
How do you teach music in distance education?
Before all the Zoom and everything.
Yeah.
Well, the subject I was teaching was called Music Style and Composition, and it was actually a subject to sort of be a way in for students who were not a whiz-bang performer. So it wasn't for performers. It was for students. It could be a drummer. It could be a passionate listener to music who wanted to learn about creating music, listening to music, and analysing music. So it was three different aspects of music. You weren't teaching them how to play violin.
No, no.
But it was absolutely fascinating. It was just joyful to be able to open doors to people, and we were able to choose, you know, everything from Elizabethan music through to the most absolutely written today pop music, and every style, and use it as
including
a teaching.
Including heavy metal?
Yeah, yeah, we did have. We didn't teach it, but we had a couple of young lads who created music in heavy metal style, and as long as they were following the principles of what the task was, and then we would organise for them to have performances of those pieces. So even though it was via distance, we did have a beautiful one-on-one relationship with these students and enable them to get. And to do a music subject in their VCE.
So what did you do? Phone? How?
It was bits of paper going to and fro in the post.
Right.
Incredible, isn't it?
It is incredible.
So it used to be called the Correspondence School. This school is a government school.
That's right.
And it's really about open access to kids who do not have access to a regular classroom environment, particularly in VCE, to do subjects that were smaller cohort. So we were providing the opportunity for kids in Mildura or in the bush, or young tennis stars who were travelling the world, or kids in hospital, to actually do the subject they wanted to do.
Right. Mm. Now let's come up to 2020s. How did you meet those old people you brought into the studio on the 17th of December?
The singing activists.
I just thought they were old people.
No,
they're singing activists.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did invite me to the picnic after, but I was too tired and emotional. So when did that happen? When did you meet them?
That's all sort of part of when I became sort of radicalised and
Did you just use the R word?
Isn't the show called Radical something or another?
Well, it's Radical Australia, but we just talk to people. How old were you when you became radicalised?
Much older than you'd think.
Why I'm asking.
Yeah, I know. So it was probably around late 80s that I was asked to join a group called Eureka Ensemble, was indeed a radical classical music ensemble here in Melbourne, but very, very strong links to the Eastern European communist countries. And we, in fact, so I came on board initially because they urgently needed a singer to go on the tour to Eastern Europe before the wall came down, so 1987. Mm. And it was an extraordinary experience. But then also I met through that a number of people who were very involved in politics, unions, progressive causes. And so one of the first things I did with Eureka Ensemble was we went and performed at the meat workers' canteen, the union thing, and we were, singing songs there. And I thought, wow, I have had such a protected little life.
That's right. There's a whole world out there. There's a whole world out there I have never come across.
Never come across. Yeah. And the mix of different cultures because, again, you know, if you do classical music, that is mainly Anglo-Saxons who've been in Melbourne, in those days, who'd been to a private school.
Right.
Because they were the people who were privileged to have the access.
So what other groups have you been involved in since then?
So that group was that spawned a group called New Music Liberation Front.
Right.
And that was really, we were then really trying to create progressive songs and music theatre that we could tour, and we toured to Vietnam with that. And
what was the response in Vietnam like?
Well, they really got the song, which was called "The Great Dictators." It was a song all naming all the great dictators, and the song against money and capitalism. They totally got that.
That right.
But other things, like we had a 10-minute version of Carmen, in which we were just sort of subverting the whole grand opera thing and putting it onto the instruments we had, which was, a bouzouki and a flute and a drummer and a guitar. and one singer. So they didn't. They didn't really get that. We did a Beatles medley eventually because we just didn't know what would communicate. Right. And so eventually we said, "Oh well, we just dreamed up some Beatles songs." So it was a pretty weird experience. But yeah, you know, being there in Vietnam at that time in 1990 was an extraordinary time. We were progressive here in Melbourne, where we could say, well, we're going to sing an Irish song, because that is the diaspora of Ireland is all over Melbourne, and we're going to sing a Greek song. We're going to sing Theodorakis because it's full of Greeks. This is our culture.
Yeah.
And we're going to sing songs about all these different progressive ideas. But then one of the guys who was our guide said in passing one time, there is no homosexuality in Vietnam. Mm. You say, okay.
Okay.
That's where we're at in 1990. That's the propaganda they're getting.
Yep.
So we were actually bringing a more radical approach to music and theatre, because we're allowed to here in Melbourne. You can.
Yes, yes.
I mean, we have to hold on to this and be eternally vigilant, because those rights to protest are now under threat.
Yeah.
But, you said what other groups. So I was in all sorts of new music groups, doing premieres of new music, and travelled around in Sydney and theatre works. We were doing new operas and also doing chambermaid opera. So chambermaid opera was a very extraordinary company here that existed entirely to do new opera here in Melbourne, and I was lucky to do a lot of shows with them and premiere new works and in the festivals and work in all sorts of venues and tour. So chambermaid opera was just seminal group for me, and they were extraordinary Melbourne group.
So there is a lot of things happening in Melbourne that most people are not aware of.
Yeah, well, that's right. Mm. This was a bit of a golden moment in the late 80s and 90s in Melbourne. But then what happened in 1993 was Canto Coro began, and I think maybe you may have heard some Canto Coro performances. Mm. So that was the real eye-opening thing for me in my musical and political and social justice life.
Because
we formed in order to do the Australian premiere of Canto General, the music of Mikis Theodorakis, the poetry of Pablo Neruda, and Mark Dunbar and other people who I'd met as a student here in Melbourne put this on and brought together members of the Chilean and the Greek community with some other Europeans and Anglo-Saxons in the middle, but basically the Chileans and the Greeks. As many people who'd come here as refugees and asylum seekers after the generals in Greece and after Pinochet. People come with nothing.
That's right.
And with this huge love of music and poetry. Mm. So to bring them together to do this Greek-influenced music, but with the Spanish words and these radical, radical words of Neruda about Latin America and its colonial
past.
Yeah.
And present.
And present, absolutely. So that and then that began 11 years where I really spent a huge amount of my time and energy and professional skills and work was in this community choir environment. We started commissioning works, Irini Vella and other writers and composers, to tell the stories that were relevant here in Melbourne through community choir and community arts. I do have an anecdote coming up. Ready?
I'm ready.
Yeah.
We're all ready.
I told you I could talk, didn't I? Well, so there's a 3CR anecdote. So,
you're kidding.
No, it's a biggie.
What is it?
So I'd already done a number of things at 3CR, but when Canto Coro premiered a work in the midst of the Kennedy era called Little City in 1996. We collaborated with Melbourne Workers Theatre to create a work that just was a howl of rage and resistance to what was going on in Victoria with all the schools being closed,
yes.
the public servants being sacked.
Yeah.
And Kennett. So this work went on in the what was then the Brunswick Town Hall, which was about a community barricading itself into their local town hall and resisting and creating their own little city where there was social justice and compassion. Mm-hmm. And so we were doing this show which became this well, it's one of the only I've been in two sellout successes and that was one of them.
Right.
That was just huge. It really hit a nerve and amazing staging by Renato Cuocolo. In the town hall with the community choir, doing all these simple movements, standing on tables, getting off, moving. Incredibly powerful about resistance.
Well, all I can say
yeah.
is with... Well, no, don't worry about the time. Yeah. That's my problem, well, yeah. not yours.
Yeah.
You're the guest. But all I can say is you can be lucky. And if the Liberals win the next election in Victoria, we'll have the Kennett era policies reintroduced.
Oh, I know.
And you can... You can your performance career can continue unabated.
Oh, no.
So there's always a silver lining to every cloud.
But what happened during the second? We repeated the show in 1997 because it was so popular, and we thought, well, what are we going to do to really get the word out and do something else? So we came and invaded 3CR for a whole day.
Yeah.
Oh. So we organised to be in every show from the breakfast show, and we had the choir here, and we were singing, and we had live reports from State Parliament where it said the fantasy world that Kennett was packing ration boxes for poor people. That's that he'd been set to do that.
He's very kind.
Yeah.
So when did you get involved with these this climate change?
Well, the climate choir, so that was 10 years ago. So I'd always been very interested in environment activism and working for the climate. But it wasn't until the March for the Climate in 2015 and the call went out that they wanted some singing, and this was the Australian Conservation Foundation organised a lot of that event. Could anybody lead a choir? And I thought, well, I reckon I could lead a choir. I don't know what songs, I don't know how this will work. But so we did it, and 40 people turned up, and we were at the front of the rally singing songs and found that it was immensely powerful. People wanted to sing uplifting songs, exciting songs, silly songs, where at rallies for climate change. And for the environment. And
10 years.
10 years.
10 years.
And then we kept going because people really, really wanted to do it, and we've been going ever since.
Yeah. A remarkable group of people that came in on the 17th of December. I mean, they didn't have to come in. And what, about a third of the choir turned up, or a quarter of the choir?
Yeah, no, about a third turned up. And,
They performed.
They performed, and a very, very interesting group of people. There are a lot of elders in the community because we simply have the time.
That's
and
right.
The lucky position where we don't have to be at work, and also a lot of people have grandchildren and they're very, very concerned about what the world their grandchildren are going to inherit.
Yeah.
So they want to get active and getting together and singing, being at the front line, it just gives you energy and gives you hope.
So how long do you think you'll continue?
Well, as long as my voice stands up, I think, you know, forever. I don't think...
There's no revolutionary vanguard trying to get rid of you in the choir.
Not that I've heard of.
Not that you've heard of. Yeah. Well, if there is, let us stay and we'll deal with them.
Yeah, thanks.
No, because as a music director, I think you've done an extraordinary job.
Well, thank you.
And you're continuing to do an extraordinary job, and that's the important thing.
Well, thanks, Joe. The thing is that we have a number of people, so the reason why it's possible is because we've got a number of different leaders and we've got a very active team. Mm. So nobody is just a diva off on their own.
No.
So everybody in Climate Choir, it really is a collective.
A real collective, yeah. Now, Henrietta is going to podcast this little chat, and she's going to put all the details on it about how to contact you and how to... Not you personally, but how to become a member of the choir, because we don't want you to be inundated.
No,
but as a member of the choir, how they can become. Look, it's been a pleasure talking to you. All I can say is congratulations on a life well lived. I'm glad you listened to your father and you had a second bow. And all I can – look, you're an extraordinary human being and it's been a pleasure listening to you. This is what I call – it's not an interview, it's a chat, and we've learned a lot of things. I know I harped on the past, but I like to do that because I want to show people how people develop, how they change and how things happen in life. And I think you're an extraordinary example of what you can do when you put your mind to things and you are a part of a community.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.